Hello, I am now going to talk about Comet, an active distributed key value store that we have built at the University of Washington. This is joint work with master student Amit Levy, who has been instrumental in building a prototype of this system, as well as with professors Yoshi Kono, Arvind Krishnamurthy, and Hank Levy. Distributed key value stores have become increasingly important. These are storage systems that provide a simple put-get interface for applications to store data in them. And they provide a set of really great properties, such as good availability, good scalability, reliability, no single point of failure, and so on. And for all of these great properties, they have become increasingly popular both within the data center world as well as in the open internet peer-to-peer world. In the data center world, it seems that most applications, most companies that are out there are today relying on key value stores to store enormous amounts of data. For example, Amazon uses Dynamo, LinkedIn uses Voldemort, Facebook uses Cassandra, and so on. Similarly, in the peer-to-peer world, there are many peer-to-peer applications that use the services of a distributed hash table or a DHT to store lots and lots of data. For example, the Vuz BitTorrent peer-to-peer application stores metadata for millions of torrents in the Vuz DHT. And there are many other examples. Now, in addition to this increasing popularity for single application use, distributed key value stores are now seeing an increased popularity as services that are being shared by many different applications at the same time. For example, the Amazon S3 key value store service is now being used by lots and lots of applications running both from EC2 as well as from the outside. Similarly, in the peer-to-peer world, the Vuz DHT is not actually only being used by the Vuz application itself, but also by many other applications such as OneSwarm and more recently Vanish, a security application that we ourselves have built on top of the Vuz DHT. Now, with all the great benefits of leveraging an existing infrastructure and sharing it across many different applications, there are huge challenges that arise when you try to build a real application on top of an existing key value store. The main challenge has to do with the fact that today's key value stores are extremely inflexible. They treat all applications in exactly the same way, provide the same set of properties, trade-offs, and so on to all of them, independent of their needs. And as we all know, different applications may have different and often conflicting needs in terms of, for instance, availability, security, performance, functionality, and so on. For example, one application may require perfect availability and may be willing to do lots and lots of replication for that, whereas another application may require to use the least amount of replication possible for security or performance reasons. So there are huge problems that arise when you try to force all of these applications on top of the same inflexible one-size-fits-all key value store. And we've witnessed such inflexibility and such problems firsthand in our own work with building Vanish on top of the Vuz DHT. And I would like to tell you a little bit more about our experience as a motivating example for our Comet work. So Vanish is a system for self-destructing data for the web that allows users to install timeouts for their web data. And our Vanish prototype uses the Vuz DHT to store temporarily some keys. Now, when building Vanish on top of the Vuz DHT, we encountered several significant problems with Vuz. And I'm listing two of them here. First, Vuz had an fixed eight-hour data timeout, and our system really needed flexible timeouts. Second, Vuz had an overly aggressive replication scheme that had been initially designed to provide perfect availability for all of the applications independent of their needs, but that was completely unneeded in Vanish, and it was actually a security loophole for us. We were trying to get rid of the data, and replication hurt us. So we wanted to change these things. We wanted to provide a new replication scheme that's aware of security and flexible timeouts. And the changes that we wanted to make to Vuz were extremely simple conceptually and from an implementation perspective. However, deploying them in the large-scale million-node commercial Vuz DHT was extremely difficult. First, we needed access to the Vuz designer. He was the only one who could actually deploy our changes. Second, The deployment, the commercial deployment cycle was extremely long, and you know, it took us months and months before we could get anything out. And third, it was extremely hard for us to actually evaluate the impact of our changes, such as our modified replication scheme, prior to large-scale deployment. In the end, we did it. You know, we modified VUS and made it behave the way Vanish wanted to. However, the question arises, what about the next application and the next one and the next one? Do we have to change the VUS DHT every time we add a new application that has some different needs? All of these challenges that we encountered raised the following question. How can we make a single key value store support many different applications with very different needs? In answer to this question, we propose extensible key value stores, which allow applications to customize the store's functions and properties according to their needs. For example, with extensible key value stores, different applications can install different lifetimes for their data, different numbers of replicas, different replication intervals, and so on. Now, in addition to these customizations, there is a huge opportunity here for extensible key value stores to actually allow applications to define new functions that were not possible before in today's key value stores. For example, imagine that you could have a data item track its own popularity in a DHT that doesn't support such functionality. Or have a data item that provides a forensic log of all the IPs that have accessed it. And so on, and you know, have a data item that returns different values to different requests based, for example, on the time of day or on the requester's IP, and so on. So these are the kinds of things that we'd like to support. So we want to build extensible key value stores. However, our design principle has been keep it simple. We're not trying to build a heavyweight Planet Lab on top of today's key value stores. Instead, what we want to do is to allow applications to inject tiny pieces of code inside the key value store, you know, tens of lines of code, in order to customize it according to their needs. And we believe that by adding even the tiniest amount of programmability into today's key value stores can be extremely powerful for applications. Now, while we believe that extensibility and these notions are extremely valuable both for the data center S3 world, as well as in the peer-to-peer world, this paper and this talk focus on the peer-to-peer world. This is where we have most experience, and we're going to use our experience to drive our design. Okay, so this is a brief outline of my talk. I've just gone through motivation, and I will next present to you the architecture of Comet, the system, the extensible DHT that we have built. Next, I will present a set of applications that we have built on top of Comet, and finally, I will conclude. Okay, so Comet is an extensible DHT that supports application-specific customizations and extensions of the type that I've just shown you. And the main idea in Comet is very simple. Applications, instead of storing passive values into the DHT, they store active objects. And these active objects consist, in addition to the data, they consist of small code snippets that control their behavior in the DHT. For example, they control their lifetime, their replication scheme, and so on. When designing Comet, we had a set of really important goals. First, we wanted Comet to be flexible enough to support a wide variety of small, lightweight customizations. Second, we wanted Comet to provide isolation and safety and protect the nodes of the DHT from possibly malicious code. And third, we wanted Comet to be lightweight and, you know, come with very little overhead for hosting nodes. Okay. So in terms of the architecture, the main abstraction that Comet provides is this notion of an active storage object, an ASO. And an ASO, as any other object, consists of some data, as well as a piece of code, which in our system consists of a small set of handlers that get called when an external action on the object happens. For example, when a get against an ASO is received, the onGet handler specified by that ASO gets called. Okay. To make things more concrete, let me give you a simple example of an ASO. And this code shows you how an ASO can track the number of gets against itself. And it's very simple. You just define an onGet handler, which simply increments a count and returns the value plus the count. That's pretty simple. However, look at what we've achieved. The effect is really powerful. We've taken something that was difficult and I would argue impossible to do in today's DHTs, which is to track an object's popularity. Today's DHTs just don't offer that functionality. And we've made it trivial to do so in Comet without requiring any changes to the underlying DHT. This is exactly the kinds of things that we'd like to support in Comet. Okay, so let's look at the Comet architecture now. On top of a traditional DHT layer, Comet adds another layer, which is called the active runtime. And as I said before, instead of storing key value pairs, we store key ASO pairs. Now, the active runtime, when some external action comes, for example, a GET, the active runtime will create a secure runtime environment or a sandbox for the ASO to run in, and it will invoke the handler for GET specified by that ASO. Now, the code of the handler can do a bunch of things. It can either modify its data, its own data, or it can reach outside of the sandbox via a very narrow interface, which we call the ASO extension API, and perform some external interaction. So that's the architecture of our system, and in the next part of the talk, I would like to focus on two of these components. Details are in the paper. And we're going to talk about the ASO extension API and the sandboxing policies that we enforce, as well as how we enforce them. Okay, so the ASO extension API. Obviously, this is extremely important in our system because it determines how extensible our system really is. In order to arrive at our extension API, we looked at a bunch of different applications as well as several different customizations that we believe would be appropriate for these applications. And for each customization, we looked at what was needed in terms of extensions, what was needed in order to implement them inside ASOs. And after looking at a few of these customizations, we arrived at four classes of extension points that were needed by most ASOs, or by all ASOs. First, ASOs need to be able to intercept accesses, and we allow them to do that by specifying handlers for puts, gets, and updates, DHT operations. Second, ASOs need the ability to run periodic tasks. And they can do that in our system by specifying an on-timer handler, which gets called periodically. Third, ASOs oftentimes need to get out of their sandbox and perform some interaction with their own host, for example, to get the time of day, get the node's IP, the node's ID, and a few other things. Finally, sometimes ASOs need to get out of the node and actually talk to the other nodes in the DHT. And we allow them to perform DHT operations in a very restricted fashion, such as get, put, and lookup. Okay, so that's the API. It's pretty simple and tight. Yet, we find that it's extremely powerful and it can support a wide variety of applications. And we've used it to build over a dozen customizations for various applications. Now, it's not completely general, and we never intended it to be. And we have, in fact, explicitly chosen not to support things like sending arbitrary messages on the internet or doing file I/O or customizing routing. While some applications may benefit from such features, we believe that the security implications of supporting such features are just too large. Okay. So let's look now at the ASO sandbox. We have a lot, we've done a lot of work to secure our sandbox and make it as tight and small as possible. And there are lots of details and analysis in the paper. I recommend that you read it. However, for the purposes of this talk, I only want to show you the three high-level requirements that we had for our sandbox and a few words about how we go about achieving these requirements. First, we needed to limit the ASO's knowledge and access such that, for example, we prevent an ASO from accessing the user's files or the user's memories or the other ASOs co-residing on the same node. To ensure that that doesn't happen, we use a standard language sandboxing mechanism, and we make a huge point about making the sandbox as small and tight as possible. In the end, we arrive at under 5,000 lines of code of runtime being exposed to an ASO, which is tiny. Second, We needed to limit the ASO's resource consumption. We mustn't allow ASOs from, you know, taking over the user's machines, you know, their memories, their bandwidth, their CPU, and so on. And in order to ensure that, we installed various limits, such as a per handler, you know, a per handler bytecode instruction limit, as well as the memory allocated by any handler. And we also rate limit incoming and outgoing requests for ASOs. Finally, we needed to restrict the DHT interaction of any ASO, and to prevent, for example, traffic amplification that or DDoS attacks against the DHT. And to ensure that that doesn't happen, what we do is to install draconian restrictions on whom an ASO can talk to. In particular, our ASOs can only talk to their own neighbors. And there are no recursive requests and things like that. So those are just a few words on our sandbox, lots of details in the paper. Okay, using this design, we prototyped a Comet system on top of the VUS DHT, and we integrated the Lua language, a restricted version of the Lua scripting language, into it for extensibility. And we deployed an experimental Comet DHT, you know, on a few 200 Planet Lab nodes. Now, in the future, we are hoping that we can deploy this at a much larger scale, you know, on the million node VUS DHT. And we're actually talking to the VUS designer, and he seems interested to support Comet. And I would actually only want to point out one thing, which was interesting for us, which is that the VUS designer was actually particularly interested in Comet for his own use. You know, he quickly discovered that, or realized that Comet has huge potential for debugging and experimentation for VUS itself. Okay. So let's now look at what you can build with Comet. On top of Comet, we built a set of over a dozen customizations for various applications. And our overall experience has been a very positive one. We've taken, you know, we've been able to build things that are pretty powerful using very few lines of code in Lua, you know, tens of lines of code. So that's pretty powerful. The paper contains snippets of code and discussions for all of these customizations that we did, and it's a fun read. I recommend that you read it. However, for the purposes of this talk, I would like to give you only a gist of the kinds of things that you can do with Comet, and I'll give you three examples. First, I would like to show you how Comet can support application-specific customizations of DHT properties. In particular, let's suppose that you wanted to customize the replication scheme, for example, to filter out some undesired nodes and not replicate to them. And the way to do that is very simple. This code shows it. You just define an on-timer handler for your ASO, in which you just look for the neighbors at that point in time, the closest nodes to your ID. And you select the replicas from those nodes, the ones that you care about according to some policy. And finally, you ask Comet to put the ASO to those replicas. So that's pretty simple. And in the same vein, we actually implemented the true, you know, more complex vanish-specific replication scheme that we deployed in VUS. And, you know, I'm not going to show, obviously, the code, but the code is pretty small, 41 lines of code. Okay. So this just shows you how you can use Comet to customize a DHT's properties. The second example that I want to show you is how Comet allows objects to behave according to the context that they are in. And the specific example that I want to show you is how you can build a proximity-based distributed tracker using Comet. You know, in BitTorrent, there are these things called distributed trackers, which rely on a DHT to track peers of an existing torrent. And the main property that you need to know about them is that they return random, effectively random subset of the nodes. Now, of course, a better policy would be to return, the closest nodes in latency, network latency, to the requesting node. And this is exactly what you can do with Comet. In Comet, what you can do is to have peers put their IPs in the DHT as well as their Vivaldi coordinates and at the torrent ID, where there is an ASO being stored that accumulates these IPs and Vivaldi coordinates. Now, upon a GET, when a new node wants to join a torrent, the ASO computes the closest node to the requester and returns them. So that's how you can build it. Pretty simple, and it shows how you can have a context-aware object. Now, to illustrate this point, we ran a small experiment, and this graph shows the CDF of latency between paired nodes using our comet tracker, so the proximity-based tracker, versus the random tracker. And as you might expect, you know, our comet tracker tends to pair nodes that are closer to each other in network latency. Finally, I would like to show you how the comet can turn a DHT itself into a monitoring platform or a measurement platform. So, for example, suppose that you wanted to monitor a remote node's neighbors, right? Not a node that you control, but a remote node that's just out there in the DHT, and you want to control to be able to monitor its neighbors. What you can do is you can just put an ASO, a monitoring ASO, on that node, and it will ping its neighbors periodically. And this is the code to do it, pretty simple. Now, what can you do with something like that? Well, you can actually, this is very useful for running DHT internal experiments, and which actually have the benefit of providing additional visibility over external experiments, such as the traditional experiments where you join the DHT with a lot of nodes and you ping random nodes from the DHT. And the reason why it adds additional visibility is that it can go through NATed or firewalled nodes. Just to illustrate this point, we ran a small-scale experiment that, and this graph shows the CDF of WOO's node lifetimes measured with a monitoring node like that, so a comet internal measurement, the blue line, versus an external measurement. And as you can see, we obtained pretty different results because of these firewalled nodes that are actually, there are 50% of the WOO's nodes are actually firewalled. Okay, this leads me to conclusions. I have shown you how extensibility allows a shared storage system to support applications with very different needs. And I have talked about Comet, an extensible DHT that allows per application customizations. And I've shown you how with limited interfaces and strict sandboxing, you can do a lot of things, very powerful things. Finally, I would like to point out that we believe that extensibility would be extremely useful in other environments, such as the data center environment, for example, S3. And there are many applications that we imagine there as well. And we think it's a really important avenue of future research. So with that, I will take questions. Thank you.
Hi, Petros Maniatis, Intel Labs, Berkeley. We change name all the time. Okay. So I understand that you have done a lot of work to try to be very precise about the security properties that individual ASOs will be subject to. I would say this is sort of micro-security. It's about each ASO and how it's going to be handled within its sandbox. What I was wondering was, have you thought at all or have you derived any macro-security properties? If I'm running a WOO's client on my machine, what can I expect from it? How many how much in terms of resources is it going to consume? Can I see macro misbehaviors that might be legal in terms of individual behaviors but might be undesirable?
Okay, so we actually install global limits as well, not only per ASO limits. I've only mentioned per ASO limits. We actually install per node limits on how many, and these are actually standard limits in rate limiting in DHTs. How many requests per second from a particular IP, how many ASOs in total can a node store, and so on. So we believe that we have the right mechanisms to actually limit the maximum resource consumption overall of Comet, of the Comet program. Now, the guarantees that we give, the numbers that we give, depend on those limits, where we set those limits. And I believe that we need a little bit more, experience with applications in order to arrive at the right limits for our system.
Great. And have you thought about fairness at all? You're talking a little bit about
that's
the DOS.
That's interesting. We haven't yet.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi. Chris from University of BC. My question is about the idea that Your work for Vanish was trying to get rid of replication, but if you're building a very flexible DHT, you can imagine using it for applications where you would want replication.
Correct.
Now, in a traditional DHT, replicated copies of an object are semantically equivalent to the original object. In a DHT where objects have active code associated with them, that's no longer necessarily true, because handlers that run on one replicated copy no longer access common data. The data may be different between nodes. At that point, it seems that any of these things like the popularity counts, you're now facing a sort of split data and merging problem, and you have to recover all the replicas in order to get accurate data out of those ASOs. Do you have any thoughts on that topic?
So I do, actually. So in today's DHTs, replicas, as you call them, they're inconsistent. So DHTs don't offer consistency across the replicas. You can have a client modify this replica, and you may get the latest version at some point in time, but you may also get the older one. On top of that, our system allows different replicas to evolve differently based on computation, and that is possible based on the application. However, there is also an interesting opportunity here, which we haven't fully looked into, but there is an opportunity here for different replicas to actually, because they have a little bit of code, to actually merge with each other in some application-specific way. So, for example, a count. You're talking about the count. You could, instead of storing a count, store all the IPs and merge them, right? That's getting a consistent view.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Marvin Timer, Amazon. So I'm not familiar with Lua, so I don't know the expressiveness of it. And I'm wondering, when you were looking at what you were going to enable, were you able to identify certain classes of things? Because you could imagine like limiting whether you have an infinite loop or things like that. And so if you could say a bit more about what classes you envision and what levels of language you're thinking about, that would be good.
Yes, sure. I can say a lot more. Okay, so what we do actually in Lua is several things. We modify the Lua environment, first of all, for safety reasons, to minimize what we expose to ASOs, the type of functionality we expose to ASOs. And we've essentially removed everything from the already restrictive Lua language. We've removed everything apart from three classes of things, and you asked me what they are. They are pretty much simple math, string manipulation, table manipulation. So there is absolutely no way in which an ASO can express in our language things like process creation, file I/O, things like that. Now, the second thing that we do is we limit the number of instructions that any ASO can do, and we do that by modifying the Lua interpreter, which is open source. We modify it to have a counter, and we will limit, for example, infinite loops. You can run for as many instructions, no-op instructions, as the limit gives you.
Okay. Follow-on question. Mm-hmm. If I were to expand on what you currently have, is there an interesting set that's sort of an incremental distance out? In other words, suppose I were to ask myself, what would I now add back in, and what set of applications would I enable with that? Is there an interesting boundary that you see on that, or is it sort of a gray area?
So what I can tell you is that there were applications that we thought of, but that we decided we didn't want to support. And one example that we were somewhat excited about was, we can turn this DHT into a measurement platform, a true internet measurement platform, where we could run pings and so on, to get network latencies and so on. We decided not to support such applications.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dutch Meyer, University of British Columbia. So one of the things you sometimes see in high-level languages is that there's, even though the overall performance is often very good, there's a higher variance in performance. So for example, when a garbage collector kicks on, suddenly things get radically different in terms of performance. And it seems like that's a really bad property for something like S3 that measures at 99.9th percentile. They're really close to the worst case. Do you see any problems or possible solutions? Have you thought about
it? It is very possible. This is a very interesting question, and it really goes to what should things look like on S3, for example, or other systems that require much better, you know, availability, much better properties in general. And I don't have an answer, a clear answer for that, because I haven't done the work on S3. However, I could imagine that you would be using another type of language that, for example, is not garbage collected and doesn't have such issues.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Vipul from NetApp. My question is a simple one and possibly a silly one. By adding active code to a key value pair, you essentially added some state, right? So does comment allow persisting that state in some manner so that it can be reused, or does it, is it node local, or how does that work?
Are you talking about the code or the?
No, not the code. The state. So for example, if you're doing counting gets.
Okay. Right?
So that counter value, can you persist it? Or use it or communicate it?
So it persists, you know, in our prototype in particular, which relies on the VUS DHT, everything is stored in the memory of the various replicas. Mm-hmm. And we use replication to gain persistence and availability and so on. You could imagine another DHT that actually persists things on disk and gives you more reliability, but we haven't done that.
Thank you.
Benjamin Wester from the University of Michigan. On your last slide, you had some of the uses like deleting files for Vanish or forensics. Those have the property that in order to actually work, your functions need to run every time the data is accessed on every node. Mm-hmm. That seems to run counter to your desire to sandbox things, so that if a node decides a script gets too unwieldy, it will just cancel it. So do you see this being a problem?
It depends on the application. Certain applications, so definitely on top of a DHT, applications should expect that things may fail at any, you know, traditional DHT. Things may fail at any given point in time. Your request may not be processed, actually, because of rate limiting and all that stuff. Requests just get dropped by the nodes. This is baked into the system, and we do have that property as well.
If I'm relying on this to actually delete my data mm-hmm. when I specify
well,
it to,
then you use tricks like Vanish does, which is threshold secret sharing and things like that within your application, and you build kind of reliability of your results using that
even your applications do need to be built. So the things will still work even if they don't run on every node?
If your application is designed correctly, yes, I think so. I think you can build an application, that has that property. Sorry.
Thanks.
Thank you.